I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. L.M. Chilton's new novel, Everyone in the Group Chat Dies, is a satirical whodunit mystery that follows Kirby, a late 20-something millennial who's suddenly at odds with a Gen Z tech-savvy armchair detective with an impressive social media following. I recently spoke with L.M. Chilton about the conflict between generations and how his lived experiences played a hand in crafting this story. So from its title, Everyone in the Group Chat Dies, we can deduce that this is a murder mystery. Just so we don't reveal spoilers, could you give our listeners a description of the book?
So Everyone in the Group Chat Dies is like if the cast of Friends found themselves trapped in I Know What You Did Last Summer. That's how I like to describe it. So it's sort of it's a satire, it's a bit of a slasher, a 90s slasher movie, and it's about a group of roommates who have to solve first the case of a missing person, but things, as you can tell by the title, quickly get out of control and it gets a bit further than just a missing person.
So the book is narrated by Kirby. Tell us about her.
Kirby is a bit mixed up. She is sort of trapped in that classic place where she's just about to turn 30 and she's sort of got one foot in being a young adult and one foot in being a grown up. And she's sort of trapped in this little apartment in a sleepy English town with a bunch of sort of messy roommates. And she's in that point of her life where she's stuck in the middle. She's got a bit of a dead end job and she really needs to take that leap into being adulthood. And she works for a local newspaper in this sleepy village called Crowhurst. And of course, as with all local newspapers around the world, they're sort of dying out and her job's in danger. And she's sort of in this town where nothing ever happens. So her job is to go and report on local news, but it's the most boring town ever. So she's wishing and wishing and wishing that something will happen. And then one day in through the door walks Esme, who's a sort of Gen Z TikTok crime investigator influencer. She's everything Kirby isn't. She's younger, she's trendier, and she's at the forefront of this sort of new digital media. And Kirby is sort of equally impressed and terrified of this new wave that's going to kind of replace her. And that's where the story kicks off. And of course, Esme goes missing and the whole story begins.
I mean, Kirby was intimidated by Esme, who was, I believe, 8 or 9 years younger than her. And Esme was critical of Kirby's generation. And as a person who's not from either generation. I mean, I'm not quite a boomer. I think I'm Gen X. But is this kind of battle between these generations, is it a real thing?
Well, what I was trying to get at, I think, is that there's a point in your life that I sort of hit. I'm sort of a millennial, late millennial. And there's a point in your life that happens to everyone where your culture is no longer the dominant culture. And I wanted Kirby to be, in the middle of youth and adulthood, in the middle of old media and new media, and also in the middle of her generation getting phased out and the things that she likes, the movies, the films and the music, the buzzwords, they're no longer the dominant thing. So she's sort of being replaced by this new culture. So I do think there's a point in everyone's lives where that will happen. So I think Kirby very much feels that, and that's why she sort of desperately jumps into this new world of digital media and social media with both feet first, not really knowing how to do it, and gets herself into quite a lot of trouble.
Give us an introduction to Crowhurst. Is it a real place or is it based on a real place?
Yeah, it is based on a real place that I grew up in called Crowthorne. I grew up in this little village in the south of England that really is just a commuter village where people buy houses and bring up families and tend to commute to the bigger cities nearby. So nothing ever happened there. I think a lot of people might think that they're quite quaint and kind of suburban, these little English villages, but there's always a bit of darkness behind the scenes. And there's always a bit of people drinking at bus stops or teens going out and taking drugs in the park at night and stuff. And there's always a little bit of danger, a little bit of sleaze. And it's never quite as, Richard Curtis rom-com as they might seem in the movies. So, yeah, I based Crowhurst on that town where I was growing up. Luckily, there were no murders where I grew up. But I wanted to sort of show that places like where I grew up, Crowthorne, aren't always as nice as they seem, I guess. And Small town murder mysteries are always fun, aren't they?
On that subject of new media, I do imagine that it would be a bit intimidating to write about this world that's constantly changing and evolving. I mean, just when we think we've mastered the new thing, the next thing has come along. How did you feel about writing within this world, specifically the video like TikTok style platforms?
Yeah, it's interesting. My previous book, Don't It's Quite Right, was about dating apps. And so I was looking what, sort of the dominant app and the dominant thing in digital culture today to follow that up. And that was very much TikTok at the time. And there was a couple of big cases in the UK of missing persons. One was an adult middle-aged woman, married woman who just went missing. And one was a teen in Greece who went missing. And both those stories kind of captured the public imagination, were very much on the news. But what happened was that was different than 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, is you got loads of videos about it and loads of these sort of social media detectives actually going to the crime scenes and messing up the investigation, stomping all over the crime scenes. A few of them actually got arrested. And everyone was, rather than getting their news from the TV news, they were getting the updates from social media and sort of getting involved. And these videos were racking up millions of hits, more people than were watching the actual news. So I thought that was a fertile ground for, thinking about where we get our news from and what we trust and how can you trust, a lot of young people this were going to these crime scenes and digging up and basically crowdsourcing the investigation to their followers. What can you spot in this footage? Oh, I spotted a hat was left near this tree. What does that mean? And obviously they've got no qualifications in detection. And yet, because they were getting all these followers, they kept doing it and kept getting further and further. So that was the inspiration for the book. And I was sort of interested in how we've switched from our traditional media, our newspapers and television, to social media for news. And I think, I think there's about 30% of young people in the UK get their news from TikTok now. I found that quite scary. I was a journalist myself before becoming a novelist. So it's very much entrenched in that world of reporting. And I know how difficult it is to, get the facts, and the facts are checked, and you've got editors and everything's checked. But now we're in this new world where you can put anything out, it's completely unchecked.
Because you were a journalist, I mean, Kirby works for the struggling Crowhurst Gazette, and she's led by her editor, Trevor. So talk to me about Trevor's journalistic philosophy. I mean, he did have a few philosophical nuggets for Kirby, like the importance of truth and we serve the town, it does not serve us. So talk to me about this philosophy and are we truly losing it?
Well, local newspapers are really important, or were a really important part of the community. And if you had a local councillor or a local politician saying things, it was the local newspaper that would hold them to account. And I think one of the things that's changed with digital media is it's become more global, become, the whole country, the whole world is watching it. So you lose the focus on these local issues. So Trevor is Kirby's boss at the paper, and he's very old school. And I knew a few newspaper editors like him, and he's very much about the truth and fact checking, but he's also very much about how the local paper should be at the heart of the community, serve the community, and hold power to account. Unfortunately for Kirby, she's saying, well, the only thing that's happening is this, continual roadworks in the town, there's traffic jams, there's all the boring stuff. And he's saying, well, that's the important stuff. That's the people of the town want to know that. They're not interested in a UFO landing or whoever's getting voted for prime minister. They want the roadworks to be fixed and they want to know when they're going to be fixed. And that's what local newspapers do. And without them, you're going to lose that. And that's an important source of factual information and truth about the place where you live. So that was another theme in the book that I wanted to come across, is how that sort of news is phasing out and this new news is phasing in. But I didn't want it to be sort of preachy and say this is the right way to do things and this is the wrong way to do things. I think at the heart of the book, it's really saying that it's the humans that make the news. It's the where the news is coming from that you have to trust. You have to look at who's supplying your news. So it doesn't really matter what medium you're getting your facts from. It's what the source is, and that's the thing that you need to trust, and that's the thing that you need to go back to, because we won't have newspapers probably in 10, 20 years. So we will be getting our news digitally, and that's fine. but we just have to make sure we're getting it right, we're getting it factual, we're getting it truthful. So yeah, I think the message in all my books actually is it's not the technology that's the problem, it's the humans behind the technology.
I want to go back to something we were talking about a minute ago. It's the armchair detective trying to solve this true crime. And like true crime podcasts have been around for more than 10 years. I mean, I'm thinking of Serial, which was 2014. And because I spend all of my time reading, I really don't fit the demographic of listening to the true crime podcasts or true crime social media, you know, the Watsons who are out there. So educate me, why do you think society is fascinated with true crime? And it's been more than 10 years, at least for podcasts. Can we really call it a fad? Or where do you think this is going next?
Well, you're right to say it's always been fascinating. In the UK, we of course had the Jack the Ripper, the case in the 1800s. People are fascinated by that, which is essentially a true crime story. And there, yeah, I think Serial, as you mentioned, was the first big podcast. And I almost think that there's so many true crime podcasts now as we're sort of moving away from that. I guess what you get from TikTok and social media detectives is the immediacy. They can immediately respond to any breaking news on the story. So if something happens that day, they can put out a video that day, that minute, that second. So I think that's where it's been heading for a while. And I think what people like about that is the interaction. Like in the book, you have Esme's followers, who she calls the Watsons, because she's the Sherlock. They're interacting and saying, go there, do this. Have you noticed that in the video? Giving her hints, kind of trying to get involved. So I think that's the next level, isn't it? A podcast, you're just listening to it. You're not an active participant in the story, but TikTok and social media allows you to be an active participant in that story, which, you know, is equally terrifying and exciting, isn't it? I'm not sure that's going to be good for the world. But you know, a lot of podcasts and you know, Netflix true crime dramas are all cold cases and looking at things that have been solved. And I think what the next step forward is being in the case as it unfolds in real time.
I mentioned earlier that the book is narrated by Kirby. Can you talk to me about writing from a female perspective?
Yeah, in fact, so in my first book, Don't Swipe Right, which is about a woman who's on dating apps and everyone she dates on the apps turns up dead, and she has to solve who's doing this and why are they doing this. And that was obviously from a female perspective. And I did that because she was dating men and I wanted the victims to be men. I just thought there had been too many books and films and media in the world where it's the women are the victims. So I wanted it to be that. So that's why I swapped it to a female protagonist. And I carried that on with this second novel, which is about Kirby. I think I was aware that that was sort of controversial. And I did have some feedback on my first book, and some female readers loved it. And this has really captured the voice. And some said, we don't really like a man doing this. And I do totally understand that. I felt comfortable in that voice. And I thought it worked for the first book. And hopefully it works for the second book. But it's not a decision I take lightly. And I hope people feel that I've captured that voice without being patronizing or getting it wrong. But I'm always welcome to feedback. So if people read it and don't think so, please do let me know.
I suppose this is another question about craft. The book is set in two timelines, the present and 12 months prior. But it also includes another timeline that, you know, 30 years of collective memory of the people of Crowhurst. How did you, as a writer, keep these timelines straight as you were writing things?
Yeah, it was really tricky to juggle that because you're right. There's the. So if we compare it to, I know you did last summer, there's the timeline in which they're in the summer and they do a bad thing. These four roommates get involved in something, and then you're seeing 12 months later, and the person who they may have done the bad thing to 12 months ago is coming back. So you have those two concurrent timelines going on through the book. But also, yes, 30 years ago, there's this mystery of a serial killer, the Crowhurst killer, who was active in the 90s. And that's underlying the whole book. So you have sort of the sins of the past, and the older people in the town sort of remember this. So, yeah, again, going back to the generational things, we had the Gen Z and the millennials, and I wanted to talk about the difference between generations and when generations move on. So wanted to have the older generation in the town as well. And watching something like Gilmore Girls, when you have that very nice community, small town. I was watching it at the time writing this, and you have the older people in the town, and they command a different sort of respect, and they've got the old stories about the town. And they're the people that read the local newspaper in Everyone in the Group Chat Dies. So they're the people that tell Kirby about back in the day when she starts investigating this cold case of the serial killer. So yeah, it was really harder than I thought to juggle those three, because obviously I started off and thinking, oh, we're just going to have these two, the present day and 12 months before, and it juggles between those. But of course, once you insert this 30-year-old mystery into it as well, it did get complicated. So I had lots of graphs and spreadsheets and writing down and scribblings out. So hopefully I did manage to juggle it. But it's good because you get a mystery. You get a mystery from the 90s, you get a mystery from a year ago, and you get the mystery of today. And they all hopefully coincide at the end in one neat bow.
So you mentioned your first book, Don't Swipe Right, and Everyone in the Group Chat Dies is your second book. How was it writing the second novel? Is it as bad as we've been
Yes.
told?
Short answer, yes. Yes, it is. It's difficult. I mean, one thing, you're sort of promoting the first book as you're writing or finishing the second one. So suddenly you're talking about one book and you're writing another book. And I think when you write your first book, you've got kind of years to do it, or as long as you want, because no one's asking for it. There's no deadline. But with your second book, it's become a job, or for me, it became my full-time job. So suddenly it's not a hobby anymore. It's not something you do on your commute or after work or, 2 a.m. in the morning. It's something you get up at 9 o'clock and do 9 to 5. And you've got an editor saying, where is the manuscript? How far have you got? So that obviously gives a whole different perspective on writing it. It was tricky, but I think completing it felt like more of an achievement because it was really hard to do. And I sort of made it a bit more ambitious. I wanted it to be a step up from the first one, and I wanted to try different things, and I wanted to have those dual timelines and more characters and more mysteries. So hopefully I pulled that off. So I think while it was more difficult, it was actually more rewarding.
And how was the shift going from a journalist who writes the truth and a fiction writer who makes it up?
So when I was a journalist, I did a lot of these magazines. I don't know if you have the same sort of magazines in the States. I'm sure you do, where it's real people's stories. They're often sold in supermarkets, and they're called things like Take a Break, Have a Chat, Real People's Lives. So I was interviewing real people, normal people, non-celebrities, about kind of crazy, astonishing things that had happened to them. Big sort of weight loss stories or tragic stories where they'd lost somebody in astonishing circumstances, all these big dramatic stories. And I would interview them on the phone or in person for hours and hours and then write up their stories in their words. Sometimes it was just that their pet had gone missing, Sometimes they just collected every issue of Batman ever. So there's all these different stories. So I talked to so many different people from so many different walks of life from all over the country. So I actually think it was kind of a really good experience to hearing how different people talk, and not only talking to them, but then writing their story in the first person and making it have a beginning and a middle and an end, and actually making it into a story that people could read in a magazine over a couple of pages. That's an invaluable experience, isn't it, for writing a book? Because you really learn how to not only write it, but edit it and make it readable. So that was a lot of the sort of journalism I did before I moved into TV journalism and finding people to go on TV shows and sort of convincing them to appear on live television. So I think all that kind of went in the melting pot. And hopefully you come out with a new set of skills that you're able to use writing fiction. So it's interesting because, yeah, I wasn't the sort of journalist perhaps who was doing news, factual journalism. I did a bit of that. I worked on local newspapers when I first started. I wasn't very good at that. I always wanted to sort of have a chat and a cup of tea, whereas really, as a news reporter, you've got to go and stick a microphone under a policeman's nose and say, what's going on here? So I was always a bit better at the more kind of human interest journalism, which I suppose lends itself quite well to writing fiction at the end of the day. So yeah, I guess it seems like a big step from being a factual news reporter to being a novelist, but actually I think my sort of journalism was an easier road into being a novelist.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from the book?
Yeah, I think on the surface, it's a really fun ride. It's got loads in it. It's kind of got folk horror. It's got group chats. It's got all these themes about growing up and all these themes about living in a small village and all these themes about how social media is taking over our lives. But I think all in all, it's actually a really fun read. It's got some good jokes in it, hopefully, but it's not a completely comical book. It's a scary book. It's a thrilling book. And I think hopefully it's a great whodunit as well. So I think there's something for everyone in this one. And I hope people pick it up and go with it, is my advice.
Well, the book is Everyone in the Group Chat Dies. L.M. Chilton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Everyone in the Group Chat Dies by L.M. Chilton was published by Gallery Scout Press. Up next, book reviewer Suzanne Perez looks at a funny and meaningful novel that explores what makes a life worth living.
December is traditionally a slow month for new book releases, so I tend to treat it as a backlist bonanza, spending these few precious weeks catching up on titles I overlooked or just didn't have time to read earlier in the year. There are always a few treasures in that bunch. One of them is John Kenney's touching novel, I See You've Called In Dead. The story centers on professional obituary writer Bud Stanley. He's more resigned than bitter about his recent divorce, but he's utterly uninspired by his work and his life in general. One night, after an epic fail of a blind date, Bud drinks himself into a stupor and writes his own obituary. Bud Stanley, the first man to perform open-heart surgery on himself, died today in a hot air balloon accident. He was 44, the account begins. His wife, Miss France, has confirmed the death. He completes the fantastical obit and then accidentally publishes it through his company's system. That puts him into a sort of professional limbo. He can't be fired because he's dead in the system and they can't fire a dead person. So he's given a paid leave of absence, and that's when the 40-something obituary writer comes face to face with his own dead-end life. Bud uses his newfound freedom to reconnect with Tim, a friend and neighbor who is paraplegic. At a memorial service for Bud's former mother-in-law, they meet Clara, a young woman who likes to attend strangers' funerals just to contemplate her own mortality. The three set out on a funeral tour of sorts, meeting interesting characters along the way and gathering regularly at Tim's place to drink wine and chat about the meaning of life. Kenny's writing is sharp and sarcastic, and many scenes are laugh-out-loud hilarious. But beneath the humor lies a tender story that shines with emotional honesty. As Bud contemplates his purpose on the planet, we are reminded that life's meaning comes from spending time with people we love. The novel celebrates life and encourages living it to the fullest, and Kenny manages to do all that without being either saccharine or preachy. I See You've Called In Dead is a surprising little treat of a novel to cherish and share with others. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
I See You've Called In Dead by John Kenney is published by Zibby Publishing. Joining us now from Prairie Lights Books in Iowa City, Iowa, is the store's owner, Jan Weissmiller. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to join you.
What book recommendations do you have for us?
I have four authors, and one of them is Peter Orner. He's written short stories, novels, and nonfiction, and his newest novel is called The Gossip Columnist's Daughter, and it is about an actual person named Irv Kupcinet that was a gossip columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And the narrator is the grandson of a friend of Irv Kupcinet, and their friendship was broken. And so the narrator is trying to sort of suss out what happened between these two people who were so close at one time. And it sort of revolves around the death of Irv Kupcinet's daughter, whose name was Karen Kupcinet. She was a real person, too, and she was a young actress in L.A. when her family was in Chicago in 1963. She died right after Kennedy was assassinated, and her death was never it was never confirmed as a murder or a suicide. The family continued to believe it was a murder, but there was never anyone convicted. And he's just such a good writer. I know this sounds complicated. It's not a page-turner because he's so thoughtful, but it is driven by this plot, which is very direct. But what's really interesting to me is that during the pandemic, Peter Orner wrote a collection of essays called Still No Word From You. And it was inspired by things he was reading. He was reading classical things during the pandemic, things that he had read before, Virginia Woolf, you know, old classics. But each thing that he read made him focus on this childhood he had in Chicago. And his grandparents clearly are the grandparents in the novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. And so it's really great to read these two things together. And Peter Orner is just a wonderful writer. So I really recommend his new novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter, and his collection of essays, Still No Word From You.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, what else do you have for us?
I have Brandon Taylor's Minor Black Figures, and Brandon Taylor is an African-American novelist and short story writer that published his first novel in 2019, I believe, and it was called Real Life. And it was a Booker Prize finalist, even though Brandon was not yet 30, I think, and it was his first book. And he followed that with a collection of short stories called Filthy Animals that is an amazing collection of short stories, and another novel called The Late Americans, and his new novel, Minor Black Figures. Brandon writes very well about art. He's a polyglot. He knows a huge amount about film, a huge amount about philosophy, a huge amount about painting, and all those things come to the fore in Minor Black Figures, and you cannot read a sentence in this book that isn't just a beautifully crafted sentence. And another thing about it that really compels me is that he believes and is interested in how art should be timeless and distinct from politics, which is not kind of the received wisdom of the moment. And so it's interesting to read the thoughts of Wyeth, this character Wyeth, who's the painter, on that topic.
Okay. I know you have more on your stack.
Yes. So I have The Phoebe Variations by Jane Hamilton. And Jane Hamilton is a Midwestern novelist who started publishing in the 1990s. And her second book, I believe, was an Oprah Winfrey pick that really threw her into sort of fame because it was in the early days of Oprah picking books. And it's wonderful to have a novel of hers after a 10-year silence. And this novel is it's about a young woman named Phoebe who's, as the novel opens, just graduating from high school. She's been raised by a single mother who's a hippie of sorts, and she was adopted. And her mother decides that she needs to meet her birth parents. And she does. She agrees. And she goes with her mother and her best friend, Luna. And Luna is also a fabulous character. And Luna and Phoebe's relationship, which began when they were in junior high, is very central to the book. But when they take this road trip to meet the birth parents, she's changed by this experience, and she can't go to college. And her life takes another turn altogether, which is not a turn that doesn't include Luna. But it's a really wonderful book, and I do want to say that if you read this and like it, I would also highly recommend her novels, The Short History of a Prince and When Madeline Was Young. And it did also occur to me that The Phoebe Variations has something in common with a novel that came out in the summer, a new novel by Michelle Hoonavan called Bug Hollow. And so I would also recommend Bug Hollow to anyone who likes The Phoebe Variations.
Jan Weissmiller, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you.
You can find a list of Jan's book recommendations in today's show notes at kmuw.org. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.